Okay, hello everybody. I am very, very happy to be here with you and to see all of you here in this amazing, magical venue that we have. I'm going to begin by reading a couple of emails. Hi, John. Thanks a lot for giving me the opportunity to ask questions during the meeting. I could not do so because at present I don't have a microphone. My two questions were, one, concentrating on the sense of individual self not, that's K-N-O-T, is painful, and because of that we instinctively avoid it. A deep anxiety may force us to some extent to look at the not, and it may be extremely frightening and may be an extremely frightening and painful experience. Sometimes I am brave enough not to run away from confronting this pain, and the pain may subside, and then I experience some relief. That's the first question. I guess I'm not sure exactly where the question is in that, but I will say this. It is true that we are, I don't know if instinctively is the right word, but we are certainly conditioned to resist all inclination to look directly at the feelings of claustrophobia and contraction and limitation and fearfulness and hopelessness and worthlessness and all of those things that comprise this knot that you are speaking of. It's certainly true that we would much prefer to look elsewhere than at that knot. Even looking at it, there is available to us a great range of distraction, most of which comes in the form of commentary about the knot itself, or commentary about the difficulty in looking at it, or honoring of the hope that if I look at it, I will find some relief. The point of the vichara, and as we have spoken about quite often, more often lately than I used to in the past, one aspect of the vichara is precisely to find the feeling of contracted me that seems to be the subject of all the suffering and all the confusion and all the stupidity that so characterizes me, and that the point of looking at that internal sensational experience, that phenomenon of sensation, the point of looking at it is not to find relief. The point of looking at it is because that knot, when seen in the absence of the commentary, or in seen in the absence of the attention on the commentary about it, that knot actually is a kind of a surrogate for reality. It's kind of a surrogate for the feeling of self, the sense of self, the sense of being. And when looked at, it provides us with a target of focus and becomes for us actually a doorway into reality. Now, the point of this exercise, the point of the exercise is that Ramana called taking ego by the throat and holding on tight to it. And I don't think Ramana used the word ego. That's just a translation, English translation of whatever word he was accustomed to use for this. The whole point of it is to get that taste of reality, that taste of self that resides at the very heart of this seeming knot of confusion, stupidity, claustrophobia, and limitation. It's not in order to do away with it. It's not in order to relieve us from the burden of it, because in truth it is no burden at all. It is an arising phenomenon that rises and falls as do all phenomena. The point of it is that it is an object of easy focus, which, if attended to, will bring the arrow of individual consciousness into the presence of the light of reality. And the whole purpose of the vichara from beginning to end is to expose this apparatus, this person, this sense of individual consciousness to that light, not to find relief, not to resolve questions or issues or so forth, but just to get exposure to the light, because it's the exposure to the light that does the job. So I suppose that what I have to say about this is that there are two approaches to the vichara, or it seems like there are two approaches. In the end, they're not. But it seems like there are two approaches to the vichara. One is the one that I just spoke of, and the other is the sort of free form, seeking with attention the connection with the sense of self. This is all there is to the vichara. And the only point of all of it is to bring personal consciousness into contact with the light of reality, thereby exposing this underlying inference and conviction that I am at stake in this life to the light of reality, which will snuff it out. So there are times when it is easier and more natural to look at this seeming knot of confusion and seething hopelessness and so forth. And there are times when that is not so present and not so available to us. But at all times, the sense of self is here. The feeling of being is here, accessible to us at all times. And the whole of the vichara, the whole of the inquiry, is bringing your attention into contact with that again and again, repeatedly. And I will say that the investigation, the investigation into the nature of this knot is actually very useful, primarily because of the fact that it is so, when it's here, it is so vividly and vibrantly present and easy to see. I hope that helps the second question. Not that I hope that helps the second question. I hope that helps. And the second question that I am confronted with here is this. Eckhart Tolle recommends basically, one, feeling the inner body. That is, feeling the body from inside, so to speak, i.e. feeling the energetic body or the energetic field of the inner body. And two, being intensely aware of our neurotic thoughts and feelings. E.T. calls them collectively the body of pain. He does not use, as far as I remember, the words neurotic neurosis, but rather insane and insanity. Well, I'm sorry to say that I'm simply not qualified to comment on Eckhart's teachings. I really don't know anything about them apart from what you've just told me here. Nor do I have much interest in them. My interest in my work, the focus of all of my attention is on you. We actually, although I speak about Ramana here, I speak about Ramana not because we are here to talk about Ramana and Ramana's teachings, but because there are certain elements of Ramana's teachings in my own experience that brought me to an end to the adventure of misery and suffering and heartache. And Ramana, and since it was from paying attention to what Ramana said, although much of what Ramana says I can't make much sense of, it was by paying attention to what Ramana says, convinced that there was something there that would guide me, that actually led me to the end of the warfare with this life. So I talk about Ramana from time to time. But I really don't have any interest in spiritual teachings. I really don't have any interest in spiritual teachers. I really don't have any interest in any of that. My interest, again, is in you and in communicating to you the absolute and utter simplicity and ease with which the vichara can be initiated, and the absolute infallibility of the vichara to bring about an end in your own life to the idea that you are trapped in it, at stake in it, that there is something about it that has to, about which something has to be done, or there is something being done that has to be stopped. This is all in a different realm than the realm that I am speaking to. The realm I am speaking to has nothing to do with feeling inner bodies. It has nothing to do with awareness or lack of awareness of neurotic thoughts and feelings, although I have no objection to any of that. What I am here to deal with is all about identity. All the rest of it, all the misery that attends to the rest of the display, the manifestation that is the human life, all the rest of it is beside the point when the issue of identity is addressed. It's not that that stuff is beside the point in the life, and it's not that it is not, there are not very useful and effective and practical measures that can be taken to ease, for example, the pain in the body, or to ease, for example, the pain in the neurotic mind, but just that that's not my realm. The realm that I operate in is all about identity. It's all about communicating to you and to everyone that I can reach with it the possibility of settling the issue of identity once and for all. Of settling the issue of what am I once and for all. Of settling the conviction, the underlying, unseeable, inferential conviction that there's nothing to me but this life. The things that are done within the life to make the life more fruitful or more beautiful or more fragrant or more easy, these things I am highly in favor of. It's just nothing to do with me. And then he says, a previous question has been whether a gradual increase of feelings of equanimity and so forth should be noticeable in time with the practice of self-inquiry. Again, yes, but the way and the shape in which the arising equanimity is seen varies according to the predispositions of each individual human being. For me, the equanimity was fully present and undisturbed for some time before, in retrospect, I noticed it. For others, it may be immediately noticeable. This is what makes if there's anything that makes the vichara hard for people to embrace, it is this. There truly is no confirming sign that appears. The life is not transformed. The life is not transcended. There is not enlightenment that suddenly clarifies everything and removes all confusion and doubt. The life itself is not dramatically disturbed by the vichara, the shape of it, the way it expresses itself, its quirkiness, its neuroses, none of that. There's nothing that can be looked at within the way that the life is unfolding, apart from eventually the noticing of the fact that you're not afraid anymore, the noticing of the fact that you're not holding your life at arm's length anymore. But it's my experience that that consequence is in place before you notice it. But there are no samadhi experiences. There's no easing of the burden. There's no making you into a beautiful and fragrant example of human existence. There's none of that. The sole confirming sign that I can see that is pretty consistent with everyone, the sole confirming sign that the vichara is at work, is the fact that the vichara, the inquiry, the quest for self, continues. It's continuation that confirms the fact that it is doing its work. In the beginning, it may seem like continuing the vichara is dependent upon your doing it and remembering to do it and making sure that you don't forget to do it. In the beginning, it may seem that way. But the fact is that the vichara is what these lives are about. This adventure, this exploration of reality, is the entire point of these lives. And it has actually been the driving force behind all of our efforts to become what we want to become what we should be, to do away with what we don't want, to do away with what we don't want to be, to do away with the bad, to hold on to the good. All of these things are aspects, are wrong turnings of the vichara. The life itself is the vichara. The life itself is the vichara. So that once the direction is corrected and no longer are we looking for things to do to win the war, the internal warfare between good and evil or effectiveness or worthlessness and worthwhileness or any other dyad like that. Once the energy of the investigation, the energy of the exploration, the energy of the quest for self is turned in the right direction, is turned looking for the sense of self itself. Once that occurs, it is to be expected, and it is natural, and it is pretty much universally reported that it continues on its own, and has been from the very beginning. So if you notice that it occurs to you to do this, I often say that you should look at yourself whenever it occurs to you to do so. You should not berate yourself for the times that you are not doing it, because the times you are not doing it don't count. It's only when you are doing it that it counts. And if you are doing it, whether you are doing it, whether you think you're doing it right or wrong, if it is occurring to you to look inward, looking for the reality of what you are, again and again, over time, then that itself is the confirmation that the vichara is having its effect. And not so much, the gradual increase of feelings that have equanimity and so forth, although those feelings will eventually hold sway. Okay. Here's another email. Hi, John. Thank you ever so much for your steadfast service. I listen to your podcast nearly every night to soothe me to sleep. Okay. I attend therapy with a woman whom I respect. She is open to Ramana self-inquiry and genuinely interested. I describe my understanding of the practice as in part, seeking myself as is, not as means to improving myself or personal growth, and she agrees. Then, when she asked me what we can do with the session, the therapy session, to make it helpful to me, I have repeatedly replied that it already is. Having her listen to me while I cry, rage, or report good news feels satisfying and comforting to me. She believes that I am avoiding by venting and that it is not a two-way conversation. She wants my trust in her expertise. She makes a very compelling, informed argument that I won't detail here. Is it my practice with this to witness myself, seeing that it is not just in this arena that I desire an agreement to disagree without making the topic off limits or the feelings contentious? Is it my practice with this to witness myself, seeing that it is not just in this arena that I desire an agreement to disagree without making the topic off limits or the feelings contentious? Well, I confess to being a little confused here, so let me start back here. I describe my understanding of the practice of self-inquiry as in part seeking myself as is, not as means of improving myself or personal growth. I suspect that there may be a little confusion here about what it is that we're speaking of when I speak of self and you speak of self. And the reason that I suspect there's a little confusion here is because if there were not, it would be very strange to hear you describe the practice as seeking yourself as is and not as a means of improving myself. The improvement of the person, the improvement of personal consciousness, the improvement and the amelioration and the correction of neurotic quirks and neurotic strategies and conditioned arisings that have formed your personality. The effort, for example, to make the body healthy by eating well and by exercising. The effort to ameliorate and ease the neurotic issues and anger or repressed anger and all of those things. These are worthwhile endeavors. They really are. They are worthwhile endeavors in the same way that it's a worthwhile endeavor to keep your car well maintained and to fix the problems that arise in it, to take care of your cat and see that the cat is taken care of and well fed and happy. These things are worthwhile endeavors. It's not that the vichara is like one pole and efforts of self-improvement are another pole and one must give in to the other. It's not like that. The vichara has no interest in the continuing work that's always going on to try to perfect the personality. The vichara does not serve that work, but nor does it despise it. It is beside the point to the vichara. if you are in therapy with this woman whom you respect and who you have been honest and open with and so forth, and you think that she has something to offer the personality, something to offer the poor, tormented, neurotic person, then why wouldn't you take advantage of that? If you have a headache, you would surely take an aspirin. If a woman has something to offer you in that realm, why wouldn't you take advantage of it? It is wonderful that you speak to her about the vichara. This is a great gift to her as well as to you. But the work you do with her in the therapy is beside the point to the vichara, beside the point to the inquiry, beside the point to the investigation into identity, the exploration of identity. Continue the vichara. Continue looking at yourself. You have nothing whatsoever to say about the way in which you relate to this relationship with your therapist. It is not to be your practice to find the correct way of being in relationship to this, not your practice as far as vichara is concerned. It is not to be your practice to be detached and disinterested in the work that's done on the personality and on whatever, disabilities that may be a part of the personality. The practice of the vichara is all entirely about settling the issue of identity that underlies all of the arising of neuroses and insanity and anger and aggression and protection and so forth. To settle the issue of identity, which itself is the cause of all of the misery and suffering and fearfulness that give rise to the neurotic efforts we make to protect ourselves against this terribly dangerous life. Since we are so convinced that we are at stake here. I tell you this, if you will continue the vichara, and you will, I'm certain of that, if you will continue this investigation and this adventure, all these things will turn out right. There's nothing about the investigation into the nature of identity that has anything to say whatsoever about the relationship between you and your therapist. That may be good, it may be bad, it may last for a long time, it may fall away. Okay, here's another short one, and then there's one more which is kind of long, but I'm going to do it too. This is a short one. This is from someone that I spoke with on the phone recently, and writes to me, "Still, I wrestle with myself and my mind and this whole business." Of course, it's okay if you wrestle with yourself and your mind and this whole business. That's there's nothing wrong with that. That really is beside the point. It may be fun, it may be miserable, but there's nothing wrong with it. "I know the wrestling is needless," this person says, "and that makes it even more frustrating." Well, if it's needless, it'll go away. If it's needful, it'll stay. Frustration is beside the point. "I thought I should check in with a few more questions I have, if that's all right. It's regarding some things Ramana has said that I'm only now noticing." So, regarding some things that Ramana has said that I'm only now noticing, the first is, Ramana describes seeing oneself as awareness, consciousness, bliss, and often mentioned how it is a kind of rest. Does this mean that when one inquires but does not experience this bliss, this as bliss or rest, that one is not really inquiring? I know you will say no, but I hope you can expand on it a little more. Ramana says a lot of things, you know, and context is everything. It's in all things, context is everything. And Ramana says a lot of things, and he speaks always to whomever it is that he's speaking to whatever it is that seems to be salient in whomever it is he is speaking to. I'm not going to try to second-guess what Ramana meant based on a quotation of a quotation of something that was translated and written down after he said it to someone I know not whom. So I'm not going to comment on Ramana saying that seeing oneself is Satchitananda or any of that stuff. But I tell you this, that the way that you know if you are inquiring is because you are inquiring. If you are steadfastly and earnestly with eagerness seeking to settle the question of identity, seeking to have the direct sense of self, the direct sense of being here, if you are doing that enthusiastically and eagerly, then you are engaging in the vichara, and all will be taken care of in the end. If you are not doing that, if instead what you are doing is concerning yourself about Ramana, what Ramana meant when he said that seeing oneself is Satchitananda, or concerning yourself with whether or not you are actually experiencing bliss or rest, or concerning yourself with whether you are really inquiring or not really inquiring, or concerning yourself with whether you are still wrestling with the question, how do I know when I am actually inquiring and when I am just thinking, then you are not engaged in the vichara. Of course, that doesn't mean that you're bad or that you're doing anything wrong, but that is not a part of the vichara. It's not a part of the investigation. It's not a part of the investigation, the exploration of identity. It is a part of the play of human life, and it is perfectly okay. It is what will seem for a long time to constitute most of your activity, most of your internal mental activity, as it has for your entire life. And there's nothing you can do about that. You've been unable to do anything about that previously in your life, and you will be unable to do anything about that now, even when you have begun the vichara. That's just life at play. Life enjoying itself. Life displaying its magnificence, and so forth. You know that you are inquiring if you are, in that moment, earnestly, steadfastly, with great eagerness, looking for the direct taste of the sense of self, the direct taste of what it feels like to be. That's how you know you are inquiring, because you are inquiring. The target is very simple. It's not complicated. The target is the sense of self. What you're looking for is the sense of self, whether it masquerades behind a knot of confusion. And I'm not talking about the product of the knot of confusion, which is the commentary and the ideas about what I should do and what I shouldn't do and so forth, but the nonverbal, uncommenting center of misery and heartache and limitation and so forth. If you are looking at that, then you are inquiring. If you are looking for the sense of self, then you are inquiring. Everything else is other stuff. And it's okay. Really, it's okay. Doesn't hurt anything. Doesn't help anything. And I often don't know what Ramana meant when he said things. The one thing that I know that Ramana meant, what I know what Ramana was speaking about, is the vichara itself, is the primacy, the vital nature of the effort, the eager, steadfast, earnest effort to see yourself directly. And I know that because I did my best to follow his advice and discovered it to be, well, the secret of eternal happiness. The second thing is, my friend goes on, and the second thing is, Ramana often seemed to say that some people would be better off watching the breath or doing some other mental exercise to strengthen the mind's ability to focus single-pointedly itself. He almost made it sound like a requirement. What do you have to say about that? I, too, often encourage people, advise people, and even teach people to engage in simple mindfulness meditation of the sort that you are speaking of. I think that it can be very useful in the vichara. It's not useful in seeking enlightenment or seeking the establishment of mindfulness or in seeking quietude or stilling thought or any of those things. But it is quite useful, as you point out, in strengthening the mind's ability to recognize that it actually has the capacity to disregard the whole train of thought that it's accustomed to jumping on, not to stop it, but to disregard it. It is actually quite capable of disregarding that whole train of thought and instead putting itself on whatever it chooses to put itself on, in this case, the sense of self. So, is it necessary? No, it's not. No one can, there's nothing whatsoever, there is no prerequisite, there is no stage of the path, there is no precondition, that no merit, no understanding, no any of that, that must be in place in order for you to see yourself. Nothing is necessary to that. This simple mindfulness meditation can be helpful to some and not so helpful to others. If it is helpful, then you'll know it's helpful. If you want to do it, then you should do it, and I advise that with my whole heart. It is very effective and can be very helpful. But it's not necessary. It is not even sufficient. Well, it's not sufficient and it's not even necessary. You can respond to this during the online meeting if you'd like, or to me directly by email, or you don't have to respond at all, because no answer to any question can ever hurt or help me, can it? Right. No. Nothing. Nothing whatsoever can hurt you or help you here. No knowledge or understanding, he goes on, can help this self-inquiry in the slightest. Yes, you're right. No knowledge or understanding whatsoever is of any use in the vichara. The only thing left is to just do it. Yes, yes, yes. Even when you don't know how, he says. Yes, yes, yes. Even when you don't think you can, even when you don't understand what the hell you're looking for or looking from, just do it. Would you agree? Yes, yes, yes. Just do it. And to steal somebody else's line, si se puede, we can do it. Okay, I've got one more email. I'm on a roll here, and this is a long one, but I'm going to read it anyway because I am. Dear John, it has been 2 months now since I met you the first time at Santa Monica. I have been following the self-inquiry practice very closely since then. It has been going really well for me. there are two main reasons that make me write this letter to you. One is to report to you my progress with the practice so far and to get some feedback from you as to whether I am on the right track. The other is to ask you some questions that have arisen to me from time to time. I come from a background of practicing various meditation methods for close to 10 years, and I started to do self-inquiry in my regular sitting period at the morning or evening, in addition to the momentary ad hoc opportunities I get throughout a day. To my surprise, I found that I can let go of my previous methods and follow your new instructions fairly well. I just want to make a little side comment here. It's natural to phrase this way, that you let go of your previous methods and follow the instruction. But really, there's no need to let go of anything. Once you start following the instruction, what's really the case is that the instruction is really easy to follow and really doesn't interfere with the previous methods. He goes on, typically each sit goes through the following three stages. The first stage is where there are still thoughts in my mind. I use to whom are these thoughts, or who is the doer, thinker, carrier of the thoughts. Quickly the thoughts go away. Lately, the first stage tends to last very short. A lot of times I can get to the second stage right away unless there's a lot going on in my mind. Well, first of all, yes, to whom are these thoughts is a question that can direct your attention to the subject of the thoughts. And the subject of the thoughts is exactly the right direction for your attention to be headed, looking for the subject. Because, not because it's the subject, but because the subject is you. Because the subject is self. The point of the vichara is to get the sense of self and to raise the question, to whom do these thoughts appear? What is the subject of these thoughts is turning attention toward self. But never forget that subject is self. It's not something other than that. Also, the vichara doesn't require that your mind be free of thought, just as a passing commentary there. I mean, it's okay. Although actually, you know, to say thought-free mind is oxymoron. So far as anyone has ever been able to determine, mind is thought itself, and it is nothing apart from that. The second stage is when the thoughts are becoming very light and sparse between. Now I am aware of all kinds of surrounding sounds, such as sounds of birds singing, cracking noise of the building, faint conversations of neighbors. I am also aware of all sorts of body sensations, such as tingling sensations of my skin in contact with cloth and air, waving sensations of breath and internal air movements, and numbness or light pains from legs. At this stage, I ask myself, to whom are these sensations? Who is the receiver of these sensations? This inquiry has the effect of taking my attention away from the sensation and slowly takes me to the third stage. Again, the target of the vichara is not the subject of the sensations, and I'm not trying to parse this too closely. I just want to be sure that we are talking about the same thing here. It's not that I'm trying to quibble over your words, because no words are adequate here. I just want to make sure that we're on the same page here. It's not the subject of the sensations that we're after. It's the sense of self that we're after. And I have to say that these first two stages, as you call them, are pretty much what is the result of the simple mindfulness meditation that I spoke about in the last email. simple mindfulness meditation has this effect, and the effect is to have simultaneous awareness of a whole range of thought and sensation and so forth. Sensation is thought too, you see. But to have full awareness of the whole range of, but you know, disinterested awareness in the whole range of thought and sensation and so forth that are present in the mind as the mind, without following reactive impulses that are our usual relationship with these things. And therefore, the thing that I want to be clear about here is that the goal here is not that mindfulness. You know, the goal in Buddhist mindfulness meditation seems to be mindfulness, but that's not the goal in using mindfulness as an adjunct or a platform for the vichara. The goal of mindfulness in the vichara is to isolate and empower the capacity to move attention, as you point out, away from sensation. Away from sensation toward the sense of self. Toward the sense of self. That's the target. The third stage is when the sensations are getting lighter and lighter. The boundary between the inside and outside of my body is disappearing. What is remaining is this vast space of silence, stillness, consciousness, and a sense of existence. At this stage, I ask myself, am I still here? What does it feel like to be here? Stage three is as far as I normally get. With what I have learned about self-inquiry, I seem to be fairly content with the process. I don't have much of a desire like I used to have to go deeper because I understand and trust the teaching that it is the touch of the light of reality that does the work rather than seeing the reality directly. As you can see that I blended the self-inquiry method into my regular meditation routine, could you give me some feedback as what do you think of this blended approach? Am I on the right track? And what can I do to improve? Well, I've already spoken about the meditation technique itself and its usefulness in this adventure of the vichara. What you can do to improve it is to bring your attention, like where you say, at this stage, I ask myself, am I still here? What does it feel like to be here? You don't report to me that this results in the movement of attention focused toward the sense of self, toward this feeling of being here, toward this certainty, this absolute certainty of existence. It is fine to be in this peaceful and tranquil state that you describe as the third stage of the process, with sensations lighter and everything's fine. But I just want you to see that that is a platform from which to move your attention, not deeper. You're right about that. Not deeper, but to a more direct, focused connection with the light. The questions that I have, he goes on, are more on the theoretical side. I guess he means the other questions I have are more on the theoretical side rather than on the practical side. And of course, everybody knows how much in love I am with spiritual and metaphysical theory. But we'll see. I do understand self-inquiry is about practical practice. It is all about practical practice. It's pragmatic entirely. He goes on, theoretical knowledge and understanding only helps one get into the door, but does not have much value to get rid of the lie. But these questions do come to me from time to time. I say theoretical understanding doesn't really help one get in the door. It is a repository for the and a focus, focal point. And maybe it does help one get in the door. It's a repository and a focal point for the natural human desire to be free from misery and fear. It is it beckons to us, seemingly from a far shore, of equanimity and peace and open-heartedness and generosity of being, which inflames the desire. The inflammation of the desire, however, can lead one to the vichara, or it can lead one to all sorts of other, basically time-wasting exercises that are entertaining and may even have some good effect from time to time, but basically are distractions from the actual vichara itself. And this is the reason why I have little interest in theoretical ideas. They had their way with me, and then they went away. So he goes on, in your teaching, you often ask your audience, are you here? Sometimes you ask that question as if you want to hear a yes or no response from the audience. There were times you would even entertain a debate if someone challenges the always here-ness response. Sometimes I wonder if it's even possible for anyone to give an answer. When it comes to answer a question, it is a job that the mind performs. Self cannot answer questions because questions and answers involve objects, forms, and languages, while self is beyond objects. Who says that? If we use the mind to answer that question, the answer does not mean anything because the answer could go either way, just like a thought comes and goes. Every time when I ask myself this question, I can intellectually convince myself that I am always here, but I cannot get an absolute certainty. How can I ever get anything certain with my mind? Here's a well-kept secret. It is the mind that does the vichara. It is the mind in which arises the desire to be free from fear. It is the mind that is the actual realization of self. It is the mind that wants to be free. It is the mind that is distracted. It is the mind that becomes focused on the task at hand, which is the settling of the issue of identity. You are absolutely right and completely orthodox in your understanding that there is no answer that can possibly satisfy the question, am I here? Just like with Ramana, the things that I say with people in these meetings and these conversations are, context is everything, and just like I'm not going to speculate about Ramana meant or thought he meant or was doing, I'm not going to speculate about that with myself either, because I don't remember what I speak to is what's brought to me. And what's brought to me here is not the dispute over the issue of here-ness, although I guess it is actually at the end, isn't it? But you are absolutely right that you cannot intellectually convince yourself that you exist. It's actually quite possible intellectually to convince yourself that you do not exist, as absurd as such an exercise would be, as oxymoronic as such an exercise would be. In fact, I think it's probably easier to convince yourself that you do not exist than it is to convince yourself that you do exist. But the fact remains, no matter what the thoughts about it are, no matter what the understanding of it is, the fact remains that you are here. You're not absent. It is you that's hearing this. It's you that wrote this. You are here. You are never absent. And it is my experience, for example, that directing attention to that certainty, which is not an intellectual certainty at all, it is a self-evident obviousness of your presence. That directing attention to that self-evident obviousness of your presence is directing your attention to the sense of self. Because that's all I'm ever trying to do, is to get you to taste, and by you I don't mean you in particular, but to get you to taste directly the sense of self as often as you can, by whatever name you call it, by whatever means you brings you to it, to get have the direct connection for just a moment with personal consciousness, in touch with the feeling of being, the feeling of self. So you can't ever have anything certain with your mind. You can't. The certainty I speak of is not something that is to be created or brought into being or understood. The certainty I speak of is the certainty that is always here. It's never absent. You are never, ever absent. And then he goes on, there are other times you would say that the sole purpose of the question is to direct our attention to where we could have a direct contact to the light of reality. Well, I just said that again, didn't I? I am very good with this statement, as this is where I am at with self-inquiry. Reading teachings from Ramana make the matter even more confusing. He talks about mind, world, and self, or God, being one. How can impermanent mind be the same as absolute unchanging self? Could you please speak to this matter to clarify my confusion when you get a chance? I tell you that there has never been and never will be a moment in time or out of time when you are not the total awareness of the oneness of all being. Now, if there comes a time when you can explain and clarify how impermanent mind is the same as absolute unchanging self, I certainly encourage you to try to do so. I can do so only by pointing you to the continuous, permanent experience of being human, of seeing with human eyes, with human intellect, with human mind, with human sensations. This experience itself, this mind itself, is the realization that we seek. It is the realization of the oneness of mind and self. It is the realization of the oneness of God and not God. This life, just as it is. Now, no intellectual exercise can have you understand that. Nothing that can be said or written or done will bring understanding of that to you. It is just the case. And the continuing practice of the vichara, of the exploration of reality, of the exploration of identity, will snuff out that which prevents you from seeing that. And he finishes, I know that I just started with this practice and there's a long way to go. I want to let you know that I feel extremely blessed with the opportunity to practice self-inquiry under the guidance of someone who has gone through it successfully before. It is a day and night difference between a teacher who speaks to his personal experience and the one who speaks to his knowledge and understanding. The best of all is that you are so accessible. Everything about your teaching is perfect for me. Well, everything about you is perfect for me too, so we're in that together. okay, I'm not going to talk anymore because I have already talked way too much anyway, but I will be happy to speak to you if you want to talk to me. And in the meantime, I'm just going to let go of my push-to-talk key and shut up for a while. Please let Carla know if you want to talk.
Ronnie calling from Montreal, Canada.
Hi, Ronnie. How can I be of help to you?
Hello, John. Well, I'm really happy to get connected here. This is great. My question is about an incident that happened to me recently with my granddaughter, where she kind of she went into a panic attack. She had a sore stomach, and I really felt that like a moment of urgency where I wanted to really just be there and support her, and not go into my own fear or and all that. And this moment just felt like that's where I was just totally there in myself. And what came to me were your words, you know, with that just that deep truth of your words, you know, like that you're here. And as I was talking to her, instead of like trying to soothe her or whatever, that was just what came to me to say to her, like, you're here and this experience will go and you'll still be here. And so funny enough, like, she just really heard that. And even a few days later, she called and thanked me, you know, and said that you really helped me, like the way we thank you, you know. And she's 10, you know, and somehow it seems like children are very open to that, very receptive to that space, you know. And so I'm very encouraged, and just wanted to share that. And if there's anything else you could mention about, is that what we're looking for? Is that like that moment of really just being there? And I don't know what it is. It's like, but you realize that you've always been there. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. What a wonderful report. You know, children, it seems to me, should be to eat pushovers. You know, it should be possible with children, especially at that age, maybe not so much after they get pumped up with hormones and stuff and puberty, but maybe so, I don't know. But it seems to me that with children, it should be very easy. There should be real pushovers because the apparatus of defense and separation and fearfulness and so forth hasn't been in place for as long a time. It hasn't gotten a chance to become encrusted and stiffened and so forth. Children really can hear the truth. I mean, that's why I sometimes people ask me how to deal with children, and my advice always is the same. Tell the truth, which is what you did. I'm very happy to hear this report, Ronnie. Is there anything else?
Well, that's all for today. I'm just delighted to have found you and this direct connection with the truth. I've been searching, seeking, questing for a long, long time, and using many practices. And this is just so refreshing and relief, you know, great relief to, and the proof that it's working is, yeah, life is just easier, like less questions, less anxiety about what should or shouldn't be. And so I just keep up with it, and every moment, and more, so I can't get enough of it. So thank you.
Oh, boy, there's the proof of the pudding right there. Thank you very much, Ronnie. Anybody else?
Adrian, calling from Ottawa, Canada.
Adrian, what can I do for you?
I would like to thank for my for your response to my questions in the email.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm happy to respond to you all the time.
Thank you. And I'd like to say that I have come across the teachings of Ramana Maharshi quite a long time ago, and on and off I read some of his teachings, and I'm not sure to what extent, and I get to question my motivation, but the point is you seem to repeat time and again and reiterate the fact that as long as we do the self-investigation, it is fine. Now, you added today that it's required to do it with a lot of enthusiasm and eagerness. And to be very honest, sometimes I'm not sure I have this degree of motivation and eagerness in me.
I don't. I spoke of eagerness and enthusiasm and so forth as a way of determining that the vichara is actually working, or as a way of determining that you are actually engaged in the vichara, actually, is what I use it for. And let me dial that down a little bit. The enthusiasm and eagerness comes over time. The way you can tell that you're doing the vichara is if what you are doing is looking for the feeling of being self, being you. Not self like a spiritual concept, but self as the ordinary feeling of being you. That's how you know you're doing the vichara. If that's what you're looking for, then you're engaged in this exploration into identity. If you're looking for other things, such as peacefulness or equanimity or samadhi or bliss or clarity or understanding or insight or any of those things, those things are all fine. They're just not the vichara. I just want to make the distinction between the vichara, the inquiry, the investigation, which is entails entirely seeking the sense of self, seeking what it feels like to be, and nothing else, with no nothing else but that. If that's what you're doing, then you're engaged in the vichara. If you're doing other things, then you're not engaged in the vichara. The easy thing about the vichara to tell you whether you're doing it right is the fact that there's only one thing that you're looking for, and it's that, the sense of self, the feeling of being. And the eagerness, maybe I misspoke myself a little bit there. The eagerness will, and enthusiasm comes and goes. They are states of mind, and as with all states of mind, they come and go, and they are uneven as to how they manifest in people. But one thing is certain, if, and this is to everybody so that I can clarify what I said, I did not say it the way I wanted to. The way to tell whether you are doing it right is if you are looking solely to get a taste of the sense of self, of the feeling of existence, just that, nakedly, unadorned, without commentary, then you are engaged in the vichara. Okay?
So basically not looking for any fancy feelings of quietness or happiness or whatever, but just getting in touch with our inner self.
Yes, that's exactly right. And again, I want to be really clear here. There's nothing wrong with looking for feelings of happiness and clarity and open-heartedness and so forth. There's nothing wrong with it at all. In fact, it can be quite beautiful and quite useful. It's just not the vichara. And the only thing I'm speaking to here is how to know whether you are doing the vichara right. Do you follow me?
Yes. I would like to say that one thing that called my attention in your report of how you got to vichara was the fact that you are in a state of complete despair, feeling to have lost the valuable things that were in your life until that moment. And however, you are successful, although you had a motivation, you probably wanted to get rid of this despair. Now, this being said, to be honest, I don't want despair to get me there. I'd like to go there without having to go through despair.
Despair is entirely optional. And I don't really recommend it. I often speak about the fact that I am the worst case scenario, that my introduction to the vichara, my final turning of my life to the vichara, was not done in the best possible way. And I don't recommend despair. Nothing is necessary apart from the desire to see for yourself, just to see for yourself, to settle for yourself once and for all the issue of identity, to see for yourself what you are, and that's all. Okay?
Could I summarize what you are saying by saying this, that do it anyway, do it without wasting your time on doubts and on anything, just do it, and as you say, in due time, it will take care of you.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Just do it.
Thanks, John.
You're very welcome, Adrian. I'm happy to have this conversation with you. Anybody else want to speak?
Vivek calling from Cupertino, California.
Hi, Vivek. How are you? What can I do for you? I gather that you're having difficulty with your microphone, and Carla just told me that you sent a text message to her, a question, something about effort. Of course, make the greatest effort. That's what I say about effort. Make the greatest effort that you can manage, that you can muster, in the moments that you are seeking this connection with the light, this connection with the feeling of being, this connection of the feeling of you. In that moment, in those moments, make the greatest effort. Put all of your effort into it, and see what happens. If you are speaking about spiritual denigration of the whole idea of effort, that the spiritual insight that effort is a lie, that it doesn't really, there really is no such thing as effort, then I say that if there's no such thing as effort, don't make an effort. But make an effort not to make an effort. So far as I can tell, those who tell us that what we need to be is effortless have failed to give us any clue as to how to attain effortlessness. And the reason for this is because the actual fact of the matter is that life is effortless. There are many experiences that arise in, within the life. There are great experiences of effort and wanting and not wanting and getting rid of and not getting rid of and holding on to and trying with all my heart. These things are all not what they seem to be. They are not what they seem to be. Nothing is what it seems to be. Nothing is what we think it is, including effort. But for however long it is that there resides within us this fearfulness and anxiety, this sense that I've got to do this right, I've got to make sure that I make my life right, that I think the right thoughts, that I do the right things, that I attain the right attainments, that I divest myself of the right difficulties. So long as these ideas are in play and are the object of my affection. So long as that is the case, make an effort to find out for whom this is. Make an effort to bring attention directly to resting on, not resting in the sense of having a nap, but resting on in the sense of being in touch with the sense of self, the sense of being. And that effort, that action, that decision, that choice has the most profound consequence of all effort, decisions, and choices. It is not what it seems to be, as are none of those things what they seem to be. But those efforts and choices and actions that we seem to be responsible for within the life itself have their own consequences within the life itself. The effort and the choice and the work to have the taste of the reality of what I am, to have a taste of the sense of self, the sense of what self feels like. What do I mean when I say self? What does that feel like? That effort has the most profound consequence of all. It has the consequence of snuffing out the very engine, the very fire that gives rise all of our efforts and all of our actions and all of our choices and all of our relationships with this life, with these thoughts, with these experiences, with these people, with this world, with my past, with my future. The effort to repeatedly have the taste of what it feels like to be snuffs out the source of all of that. And it is revealed finally that there is nothing whatsoever that has ever been occurring within consciousness that actually answers to the name of effort. There are phenomenal arisings that we have become accustomed to claiming and thinking of as our effort. And so long as that is the case, let your effort be to taste what you are, to settle the whole issue of identity once and for all. Let all of your effort, whether it is illusory or not, let all of your effort that you can possibly muster be directed toward this purpose, to have the repeated momentary connection with and taste of the reality of what you are, the self, that which feels like me. Okay?
Thank you, John. Can you hear me now?
Yes, you should let go of your key, but yes, I can hear you now, Vivek. I went on at some length guessing what you meant, but did I come close at all?
I think you answered a lot of my question. I guess a follow-on from that is the lives of most spiritual teachers that I've heard of seem to be characterized by a lot of intensity and sometimes passion and terror and despair and so on. It's what you call spiritual melodrama. Now, my own approach has been more of skepticism and being unwilling to believe what people have told me and therefore unwilling to put a lot of effort into it. And so my question is, how are we sure that all that melodrama wasn't a prerequisite for getting to the realization, given that so many people seem to require it? What I think about is that your approach is so easy, it seems to require so little effort, even when you're very focused at the time of inquiry. It just seems too easy.
Yeah, well, you're exactly right, Vivek. It is too easy. And, of course, it is that in those of us who are in love with the spiritual melodrama, it is its easiness that turns us away from it, that makes us seek rather something that's harder, that is more filled with the spiritual melodrama, more filled with the juice of it all and so forth. But the reason that I can say, and that without any fear of being wrong, that such despair and such spiritual melodrama is unnecessary, I have a whole bunch of reasons that are the people that I have been with over these, 10 years now, that have, as a result of doing this without spiritual melodrama and very quickly and without trouble, been finished with the whole business of the horror of life. And the most recent is the report we just heard from Ronnie in Montreal about the effect of bringing the vichara to a 10-year-old child and the absolute lack of any drama in the child's realization of that, the child's the effectiveness of that on the mind of the child. That's proof right there that you don't need despair, although the child was in some distress. But you don't need that. It goes very quickly. And for skepticism, I think that skepticism is entirely appropriate in the spiritual arena. And I'm actually often befuddled at the lack of skepticism in the spiritual arena when you consider the fact that the same thing has been being offered to us for, 5,000 years now? And we're still in the same boat we have been for all of that time? We are still seeking someone who can bestow upon us the boon of peace and equanimity and joy and so forth, or some understanding that will, or some practice, some samadhi state, some state of mind that will. I think that it's absolutely appropriate. Skepticism an appropriate face to turn to spiritual teachings. If spiritual teachings have anything for us, then all human beings should be able to receive the essence of them and be finished with misery and suffering in their lives. And my experience is, again and again, with people who are in despair, with people who are skeptical, with people who are bored, with people who are depressed, with people who are just ordinary people who don't even have, who have not come to see that their life is unhappy. Anyone who tries this, anyone, easy, whether you make it easy or whether you make it hard, anyone who tries this, in the end, all turns out right, just as Ramana promised. Do you follow that?
Yes, thank you. And I just wanted to add a comment, and then I'll let someone else ask a question. My comment is simply that I do enjoy your teaching method. Thank you for it.
You're very welcome. Does anybody else want to speak? Okay, then, we've been at this now for an hour and a half, and I guess that's enough time. I always go on at the end of these meetings about how grateful I am and how astonished I am at the miracle of this venue and how absolutely magnificent it is that we can gather together like this without the restrictions of physical, of the need for physical presence. And I will say that again now. This is magical. This is absolutely magnificent. I am so grateful to you for being here. I am so grateful to you for your willingness to try this simple, simple thing. To rid yourself of the, to rid yourself of the sense that you're in danger here. Okay, one more.
Adit calling from Morocco.
Adit, is that the correct pronunciation from Morocco?
My question is about thoughts. How do you deal with this urge to act on them? I mean, it's so difficult to just let them be.
What I say is that there's no need for you to do anything about the urge to act on thought. The urge to act on thought is just the urge to act on thought. The actions that arise from that urge are just the actions that arise from that urge. There may or may not be ways to make you more effective or more efficient or more true in the following the urge to act on thought, but that too is beside the point. There's no need to do anything. There's no need to stop doing anything about this. The thought that I want you to act on is the thought, what am I? Really. The thought that I want you to act on is the thought, what does it feel like to be? Just that. Act on that thought, and all the issues and problems and dispute about acting on thought will take care of themselves. Look and see if it is not true that you are here. Look and see, what does self feel like? When I say myself, what does that self feel like? I tell you from my heart that the only thing that makes acting on thought a problem is the deep abiding conviction that you are at stake in the actions that are taken on thought. When that underlying foolishness is snuffed out, the problem with acting on thought, the idea that there is a problem in it, will also vanish. What will snuff out that underlying conviction that you are at stake here, that you must be very careful and find ways not to do what you think is wrong to do, or to do what you think is right to do, what will snuff that out is the repeated exposure to the light of reality. And the light of reality manifests in you as the sense of self. If you will try to taste that repeatedly over time, all of your concern about what happens in the life, about the thoughts and whether they're good thoughts or bad thoughts, all that will go away. Do you follow me?
Yes, thank you so much. It was nice being with you.
Well, you're very welcome. It's nice being with you, too. I hope to see you next time. Once again, all I have to say is this. Seek yourself. Seek the sense of self. That's what the self-inquiry of Ramana Maharshi is. Self-inquiry is not a good translation for what he advises. There is no inquiry to it. There is no question to it. There is no answer to it. Who am I is not a question. It's a quest. It's an adventure. It's an exploration. It's an investigation into the bedrock reality of identity. It is the movement that will resolve the issue of identity once and for all. It is the movement, the action, that will remove from you the fearfulness and anxiety that arises solely because there is operating within you the unseen, unseeable, inferential conviction that there's nothing to you but this life, and that therefore the problem is in this life, and that therefore if I solve the problems in the life, then my problems will disappear. The life is not the problem. Thoughts are not the problem. Distraction is not the problem. Understanding is not the problem. Confusion is not the problem. It's only one problem. And that problem is this certainty that underlies everything, that there's nothing to you but this life. There's only one solution, and that's the truth. The truth that is found directly in the experience of the sense of self, the sense of being you, what it feels like to be. Not in order to become that, you are that. Not in order to do away with other things do away with themselves. In order only to resolve this issue of identity, which from the very beginning of the spiritual idea has always been seen as the crux of the problem. Well, now we have a way to be finished with that problem. Now we have a way to settle this issue once and for all. Now we have a way for everybody, not just for the few, the meritorious, the beautiful ones, the brilliant ones, but for everybody, everybody, to see that life is the perfect realization of reality. That there's nothing wrong here. That you are not at stake here. That the warfare is unnecessary. And when it becomes unnecessary, it vanishes. All of our efforts to stop it have been to no avail. When it's seen as unnecessary, it's gone. The war is over. And since we are one creature, when the war is over, the war is over. So be well. If you can love one another, if you can be kind to one another, if you can help those who need help, if you can rescue those who need rescuing, comfort those who need comforting, and if you can't, or if you can, whether you can or cannot do those things, one thing you can do is look at yourself, seek yourself in all things, all times, repeatedly. Get a sense, get this taste of this sense of self, and all will come out right. I promise. What a wonder you are. I will see you soon. Carla needs to speak to you. I'm going to go. Be well. Enjoy yourself. Bye.